Welcome back, everybody, to Season 3.
Yay!
This is our first episode of Season 3.
It's the
2018.
New year. Oh, the future with our flying cars, etc.
No, it's definitely 2018. I'm not going to make any references to the day we're actually recording this on. Hey, did you check out the new Infinity War trailer? That was amazing.
No, I don't know what date it is.
Oh man, have you checked out that spicy new meme with the Zootopia characters?
Memes? No. Yeah. Porn? Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, in reality, welcome to all of you who will be listening to this in the grand old year of 2018.
The grand old year.
Hopefully, some vast political changes will have occurred, and things will be much better for all folk.
Yes, I think same-sex people will be getting married now.
Well, I mean, hopefully still. We never know, right?
Yeah. True, true.
Oh. In the far-flung future of 2018. But yes, welcome everybody again. Season 3, thanks for helping us get here. We are here to start off this 2018 year with a bang.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we chose this game is because technically, it's now a different year from when this game was released. This is probably our youngest game, Horizon Zero Dawn.
You're just revealing all of our secrets. But yeah, to go with the new year and the future, we're going to go with Horizon Zero Dawn, a wonderful space apocalypse. Space?
I mean, Earth is in space, right?
Yeah.
Spaceship Earth.
Probably, yeah. That works.
So Horizon Zero Dawn came out in March 2017. Technically February if you were in the North Americas, but fuck off.
Oh, gee.
For the beautiful PAL regions, it was the 1st of March 2017. So, you know, kind of old, I guess. We didn't play it when it happened.
Yeah, neither of us did at all.
It was made by Guerrilla Games, which John tells me are the Killzone people.
That's a fact. Like, that's all the games they made. You look at the list, there's like a Vietnam game right at the top, and then it's just Killzone,
though, right?
Of course I've played.
I'm a
PS3 boy. No. I had the PS3.
I bought my PS3 to play Uncharted. And I played Journey, and I think that was it.
Yeah, Killzone should have just come pre-installed on the PS, like the PlayStation consoles, because it honestly just feels like a tech demo. Like, I always enjoyed the shooters. They're solid, but they're not overly inventive. So it was kind of surprised.
There is some overlap for Horizon Zero Dawn in that, because Horizon Zero Dawn is a system mover. I wouldn't say that it's dry and generic and formulaic.
Yes, yes. It doesn't have
But it is a PlayStation exclusive designed to move the PS4. It was one of their big system sellers.
Published by Sony, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, definitely by Sony.
Mm-hmm. I don't feel like it was like a seller right at the start of the console's launch.
Yeah, obviously it wasn't timed with the original release of the console. The console was released much earlier than March 1st.
I don't know how time works.
But no, it is, as you say, sort of their mid-cycle one. I mean, does that have a PS4 Pro version?
Yeah, it does. Yes.
Yeah.
You can play this game in sort of 4K.
Okay.
Which is
like the tagline of the PS4 Pro. Sort of 4K.
They used a very clever technical trick to get it to look kind of like 4K. So
yeah.
I can't be mad at them for being creative, David.
Are you talking about super sampling, or are you saying it's actually playable in 4K?
They use this thing where they do half frame.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That.
Checkerbox rendering.
I don't know the technical.
It's checkerbox rendering. I just said it. Okay. Everybody, I'm smarter than John.
Yes, we're all well aware. I sort of heard about this game. I mean, like everything. The life of a slowpoke is not understanding when things happen, because everything's always there.
Eventually a clam bites onto your tail, and then, you know, your whole life just sort of evolves at that point.
Oh my god! Did we just make a Pokemon reference?
Yeah, the first one that we finally made.
Welcome to 2018.
Yeah, after going to PAX and introducing the name of our show and like having every single person go, like the Pokemon, I was like, yeah, kind of, but also because we're slow, I just told you the premise.
No, like old-timey British. Go to the old, we've got top hats and we're quite gentle. Anyway, I heard from a lot of people that this was just a really great game. I think it came out around the same time as Breath of the Wild-ish?
Yeah, it would have been. I mean, the Switch launched with Breath of the Wild, and that was in March or maybe early April, but it would have been about that time.
I always felt that people were talking about these two games, Breath of the Wild and Horizon Zero Dawn. So I heard a lot of people really were excited for Horizon Zero Dawn, and I really, really into it and loving it, and then it does that thing that games kind of do in popular culture where everyone loves it and then it disappears.
Yeah, three of the people I was working with were all playing it at the same time, so for me the conversation had a lot more longevity because they were all playing it, and 3 weeks after getting it they were still talking about, oh, have you done this part of it yet, and that kind of thing. I tried to stay away from those conversations to avoid spoilers because I knew that we'd probably eventually do it for the show, and as always, turns out David was completely 100% right.
Also, I wanted to do it for the show anyways.
But yeah, no, I mean, my expectations about it were, you know, an open world game. I mean, I was playing Breath of the Wild at the time, and so it was difficult for me to imagine that something else would compare to the virtuosity of what Breath of the Wild was doing for me and my revitalization and my new enthusiasm for open world games. Mm. And so when they were all talking about it being great, I was like, yeah, but none of you have played Breath of the Wild.
So you have no idea what a great game is.
Of course, I mean, the peasants will have their dalliances,
David,
but
it's really hard for me to imagine you acting like that. Can we just be a bit more realistic? Like, you know, I get what you mean.
Yeah,
like,
my expectation of this game was actually that it was going to be somewhat generic. I was thinking a lot more, like, after playing the game and getting my hands on it, I was surprised and I had trouble figuring out what I expected the game to be before playing it. And I think the best analogy is probably something like Destiny or Anthem, like more of a procedural quest kind of open world, obviously with a linear core story, but I wasn't expecting a great deal of plot focus or a great deal of narrative development or character development.
The way I feel about those games is you kind of float through dioramas of violence, right? It's like there's not this tangible sense of being connected to the space.
Yeah.
Like, it's an environment to do game things in.
Exactly. Yeah. And maybe a better example, because Destiny and stuff have a very specific multiplayer focus, maybe one of the non-primary Assassin's Creeds, like Brotherhood, which is a lot more about, we made a city, go do all the side quests, there are some people who'll show up, I guess. Yeah. DaVinci's back, but it really doesn't have that same core focus that something like Assassin's Creed 2 or Black Flag might have. Hmm. Far Cry is another good example.
Oh, yeah. I had redhead protagonist, who is a woman.
Yep. Definitely knew about that.
Yep.
Lady robots. Protagonist.
Robots.
Yep. Mechasaurus. Bows and arrows, I guess.
Yeah, actually, now I think about it, that's pretty much it. It's like robots, female protagonist.
Monster Hunter might be another good example of the kind of thing I was imagining. So I was thinking it was mainly going to be go out, hunt monsters, get loot. Mm. There's a plot, probably.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I was expecting.
I think the way people were talking about it, I was expecting this game to be the peak evolution of open world games.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people...
That sort of generic Ubisoft formula.
Yeah, it's like, this is the distillation of years and years of hard work in going around a big space, collecting things and doing stuff and clearing encampments, all things you do in this game. But it was, when I was playing it, I was just like, this is what I want out of every open world game.
Yeah.
There's just something really satisfying about it. Because we plan these recordings so regularly, it was painful to rush through this game and not just enjoy it and relax with it.
See, I was able to enjoy it and relax it because I completed this game probably 8 weeks ago and I've just been waiting for John to find the time to actually play the game.
Listen, David, you had to borrow my PS4, alright?
Okay. We couldn't do it concurrently, but literally 8 weeks, John, after I gave that thing back to you.
I'm a busy man, David, okay? I got things to do.
Mm.
But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, some of my memories are a little bit fuzzy, honestly, about some of the character names and what they looked or sounded like. But the core stuff in this game is honestly pretty fucking good.
Yep.
The basic stuff I was expecting, the Mechasaur fights, the good combat, that kind of shit, easily, handily met.
Yep.
But then there's all the other stuff. This game is really clever for an open world sort of kind of the Ubisoft formula game.
Yeah.
And you've got this amazing character work and you have a very...
You have a narrative.
You have a narrative, but not just a narrative, like a really compelling one.
Yeah.
A very, very enticing narrative that is incredibly well paced and it doesn't just give you shit up front to hook you. The game is very, very, very well made. And honestly, my expectations were not just met, but completely blown out of the water by it, even though I was expecting something pretty good.
To me, that pacing is the most interesting part of this game, the way it's broken up and how you can...
We should be careful to stay away from spoilers here, but keep going.
No, I know. What I'm just going to talk about is how when you go from, like, you know, the main missions, sort of, these tentpole moments, and then you can meander around the world and the things you run into as you explore, well, the things that you run into halfway through a mission where you're like, I'll just pop over there for a bit, have a look through the scrub, see what I can find. It has a pace. The game has an intensity to it, but then it also lets you dictate that intensity as much as you want. It's like, do you want to just go hunt stuff? Just go hunt stuff. But then you're not rushed to complete things, but there is a sense of pressure. Like, anyway, it's just this wonderful stuff that's going on there.
There's a lot to talk about, and like, if we try and talk about it all at once, it's just going to be a mess. So maybe we should move through this point by point as our rundown dictates. But one of the earlier things that is very impressive about this game is the environments.
I think I spent the most I've ever spent in a photo taking
app. Yeah, photo mode.
There's a photo, like, I love it when games have photo modes that let you move around and pose and set the photos. I spent so much time just taking and setting screenshots and getting the mountains and all of the environments in frame and just sinking and absorbing it all in.
Yeah.
There was something just so breathtaking about every place you go to.
And I imagine that if you are in photo mode, you would have a proper 4K image that you'd be taking. That would be really nice as like a desktop backdrop.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
One thing that really surprised me about this is, again, it just sort of shows how shallowly I thought about this game when I was building my expectations for it. I knew you were going to have the plains like I saw in all the trailers. I knew you were going to have the forests like you saw in all the trailers.
Yep.
But for some reason, I didn't expect any more diversity of environment beyond that. Mm-hmm. But you have like these amazing variations in what you see. And it has a very not quite Avatar Pandora level of environmental diversity, but you know, you've got the snowy areas and you've got the desert areas and you have these really interesting semi-fantasy sort of cities and cultural, there's a word for it. Community center points, community.
Communities is a word for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but I mean hubs. Towns, I guess. Yeah, community hubs is probably what I'm looking for. The point is, like, there's this amazing variety of these environments, and you see elements of the old world as well, and that has different kinds of diversity to it, too.
I think something that really strikes me about these different places is each environment feels different, not only visually in how it looks. There's snow here. This place is marshy. But the way the environments themselves are laid out and you navigate through them, the snowy areas are full of rocky outcroppings that you have to pick your way through. And the open plains are just vast, flat surfaces that anything could spot you as you cross them.
Because it's a tonal difference and an atmospheric difference as well. I mean, like, you're talking about when you're out in the desert and you've got a lot of these mesas and stuff, so you can see so far and you feel very exposed and you feel very expansive. But when you're in, like, the starting area is the valley of your people. They call it Mother's Valley or the sacred land or something like that. But that's like this sheltering, nurturing, lush forest area. And so you don't have the same sight lines that make you feel so isolated. You feel embraced. That's what they call it. They call it the embrace.
Yes.
That's what it's called.
We worked it out.
But I played it 8 weeks ago. I don't remember all the names.
But what's like great about that is as you move through the story and you leave the embrace and you enter into those more open spaces until you're in those mesas in the far west.
Right? Yeah, in this land that's historically much more hostile to you and your people. Yeah.
As the story opens up, so does the environment. Mm. Wow, what a wonderful synergy of storytelling through dialogue and cutscenes and narrative and environmental storytelling.
Yeah, and it's an environmental storytelling that's very graspable. Like, I often hear that term and immediately think of Bloodborne, which doesn't really engage its environmental storytelling stuff properly until, like, 50% way through that game.
Yeah.
Whereas, as you say, this is a lot more scale. You get more of it earlier and it's paced very, very well.
I think we could just have us talking and describing every environment for the next hour. Like, I could honestly just go, oh, and you remember this part with the city? And oh, do you remember that cave? And then, oh, because I think one of the things that interests me is when the open world games, some of the ones I find that are weaker, I can't recall them. I couldn't describe to you a location. Like, I couldn't tell you what Meridian looks like. Oh, no, in this, I can. I can tell you what it looks like. It's a giant towered city, this big spire that sticks out of the landscape. But, like, yeah, there's just games out there where it's, especially with the Far Cry games, they just kind of, even though I know the navigational beats, I couldn't tell you or describe it.
You've played Diablo 3, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember basically anything from that? Because a game like Diablo 3 is nothing but world building, right? And so it's kind of like a gameplay focus and a whole bunch of lore just thrown at you.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it's much more interwoven, like in a much more nuanced way. And so when the things that we remember about Meridian are not just because they look striking, they definitely do, but because we understand narratively what Meridian is to Aloy and to her people and all of that kind of stuff. It's much, much, much better presented than a lot of other games. There is one or two things I will say about the design of this game that I think does underserve its environments. Mm. One of the first ones is because it's primarily a combat game, the camera is quite close to the character.
Yeah.
And again, this is a comparison mainly to Breath of the Wild, where the camera is quite far out. You see Link's full body and it just gives... It's a much broader frame. And so, yeah, like, when you're looking at the environment, you just feel a lot more free and a lot more open. Whereas when you have a tighter camera, it's a lot more claustrophobic and you have kind of tunnel vision in what you're looking at.
Mm.
And so some of the later environments, like the rainforest areas in the southwest, don't quite stick with me as much, yeah, as those early ones that made an earlier impression. And I think part of the reason why is, especially in those rainforests, I'm not seeing the tops of any of these trees.
Yeah.
I'm seeing like the roots and the road because of the position where the camera is.
And I think that's why I kind of valued that photo mode so much,
yeah,
because it lets you zoom back a little and just appreciate the scope,
mm,
because there is so much scope. These environments that they built, they're vertical. Just these wonderful places. And that camera, I'm always a fan of giving you like the three button presses where you can move the camera in and out.
Yeah.
But it does feel very tight. There are moments where I appreciate that when you're exploring caves and ruins of the old world.
Mm. Or like I was saying, just from a practical standpoint in combat, it's, yeah, a very responsive, tight camera and it works very well in that.
Yeah.
But as you say, like to really appreciate the environments, you've got to get into this photo mode. And I forgot that it was there a lot of the time.
Just to segue into a very boring settings-based diversion, you can tweak what appears on the screen in terms of
the
HUD.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can turn off things, but you can also set them to dynamic, which is what I did. And the dynamic system is just very simple. It's basically when you're out of combat, everything goes away.
Mm.
And that's how I'd have it. So I would be exploring this world with no HUD, but just the locational marker to go to. And it really helped draw me in because all of that fluff around the outside about your level and you're this and you're that would go away. And it would just be this focus on the world.
I did very much appreciate the ability to turn off stuff. Like the experience points, I don't need to know what that is every moment that I'm, yeah, playing the game. I was so happy I could just turn that off.
Tell me, know, when I need to make a decision.
Yeah.
Or not at all.
Yeah.
I don't need that.
I don't need
there
to know that I'm 75% of the way to this level because that's just going to make me stay up too late. Just, yeah, go away. Just don't tell me.
There's something that I think you mentioned that's the music.
Yeah. Yeah. So the music in the game as a whole is amazing, but much like, you know, you're talking about the ability that you to turn off these little annoyances that you don't really need made it much better. I really wished I could have turned off the in-menu music,
yeah,
and the music that pops up when you're, quote, sneaking.
Hmm.
Because if you're riding past a herd of mechasaurs that you don't want to deal with...
Yeah, and right, we will get to the mechasaurs, by the way.
Yeah, we will definitely get to them. But if you're riding past this, like, even if it's just like a herd of grazers that aren't typically hostile...
Yeah.
And you just like, oh, I don't want them to see me. I'm just going to sneak past and then keep going.
Yeah.
As soon as you crouch down and there's monsters nearby, the sneak music starts playing. You know, you're riding along, you've got this beautiful vista, you've got this beautiful soundtrack that just, yeah, feels so atmospheric and so tonally appropriate. And it's like, oh, hang on, give me 30 seconds to get past this group. Bang, the new music comes in and it, mm, breaks that tone.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish that the circumstances for the sneak music were a little bit more demanding. Like, it wasn't so ready to switch to it's sneaking time now,
yeah,
in the music.
I mean, ultimately, I just found it to be a nice accompaniment. I think the thing that I focused more on in terms of the soundscape was all of the wonderful sounds when you hit monsters with your sick.
The grinding and, yeah, the whirring of the servos and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the weird mechanical noises all the robots make, mm, and all the different sounds. And if I hear a whirring from behind me, I can almost tell who's about to gore me.
Yeah.
Right? From the sound of the gears clicking,
mm,
because they just, it has that little bit there. And for me, I found that the voice acting across the whole game was surprisingly better quality than most of these open world,
yeah,
games.
Yeah, no, it honestly was. I mean, we'll talk about specific characters later on once we drop the spoiler gate,
yeah,
but just as a very simple thing to say, the voice acting quality in this was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Ashley Birch plays Aloy,
yes,
who is well famous for Life is Strange, mm-hmm, playing Chloe in that. So, I mean, the person I'm hearing the most, I'm already a huge fan of.
And then somewhere through the game, we'll talk about it later. We'll talk,
yeah,
about it more later.
There's a particular character that John wants to mention.
And I'm not going to mention.
He's a fan of the actor, but it's a spoiler, so we'll talk about that later.
Yes. I'm a good at spoiler keeping. but yeah, like I think it's just gorgeous and dense and just wonderful. And hopefully I get to share some of the photos that I took so you guys can just see as well. Or maybe when we release the episode, we'll just have some of those screenshots, the less spoilery ones, just, mm, so you can kind of see what I mean when I say, look at this.
Yeah, you can also Google it.
Sure,
if you want.
But, you know, like, why not make this a little personal, David?
All just right, as a little side diversion on the photo mode. I mean, there's a lot of games that are including that now. I think Super Mario Odyssey has one. Maybe Breath of the Wild has one. But, I mean, the basic reason why is it's great for viral marketing.
Sure.
But I honestly like it. I think it's a very great example of a good win-win. I like being able to take photos, and I don't really care if that means that the game gets a little bit more visibility because of it. It's just a very harmless way for everybody to benefit.
I really was a fan of this when GTA 4 did it, and they had a full video editor editing suite built into the game.
Yeah, so because they were trying to capitalize on the whole machinima craze at that point in time.
Barjo and Hex, who used to host Good Game, they print off their screenshots into little booklets.
Oh, like, cool.
Because they play and review games over the course of a year. They're always taking screenshots and playing games, and then they just get these little booklets produced of, like, their year in gaming. And there's just something, like, really nice, like, satisfying about the idea of an artifact like that.
Yeah.
And even if it's just the photos, I actually enjoyed this enough to take mementos.
Yeah.
I want to remember this. Mm. I want to think about it. I'll look back and go, oh, yeah, that's the time this happened, and it feels nice and connects you to the story.
Yeah. For me, that's this podcast.
Aww.
All right. We should move on to some other stuff here. The gameplay, we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but it is a very satisfying combat experience game. And honestly, I mean, it's a really well built game from that perspective.
Yeah. What is the thing I always go on about in combat? It's like the choices you make are interesting and dynamic. Yeah. Normally, I mention in this gameplay section the enemies you fight, and like, oh, there's like five, and that kind of makes every fight feel the same. Well, while in Horizon Zero Dawn, all of the human enemies feel very similar. Each of the robot dinosaurs have their own unique and different style.
Yeah.
But like every single one you fight, it has its own strategy, its weaknesses, its strengths, and then you'll encounter them together with different ones. And so you've got to apply multiple skills together.
Yeah.
And there's something about having an understandable puzzle and then the execution of it that is so enjoyable.
Yeah, I think that's a really big thing for me. Like, if you compare this to a game like... I've not played a Monster Hunter, but
neither have I, which is why I haven't been making comparisons to it this whole time.
But if you compare this to two games I am familiar with, Bloodborne and The Witcher, Bloodborne is incredibly opaque when it presents different enemy types to you, and you just have to figure it out through trial and error.
Yes.
The Witcher is more like that than... this is, but there is still, I think, it's a much better balance of, you know, what you know going in and what you have to learn and the way you have to prepare. What I like about this is it still has the enticement of, okay, this is a particular enemy that has particular strengths and weaknesses, but it doesn't require quite the level of pre-thought as something like The Witcher does. This is a much more streamlined version of it.
Yeah.
For me, it still totally satisfies that thing you were saying about needing to think through the kind of hunt that you're going into.
And I think because a lot of these combat scenarios are presented like hunts, it lets you prowl and move around the space and plan. So when you're not pre-planning for a fight, you have to look at it. You get there. You have to scope it out. Mm. And the game gives you, I think I'm going to mention this now because it happens very early on, a focus device.
Yeah.
Which is basically a narrative excuse for a HUD.
Yeah, it's your Batman vision from any Arkham game.
Which works seamlessly, and it ties into the narrative in a really interesting way. It's
an incredibly interesting way, but we'll keep going with that later.
Yeah. And also it lets you be able to scan enemies and robots and visually see their weaknesses easily. So you can really make that prep. So if you've forgotten what is he weak against? You just scan him and you can just check instantaneously.
Yeah. You've also got, after you scan a monster, it's automatically added to your monster compendium or whatever. Yeah. So you can always look that back up as well in the pause screen.
True.
So again, it's very accessible, but still, like I said, totally deep enough for me in that way.
I played on the medium difficulty. How did you find...
I played on standard. There were one or two of the challenges that were a bit rough.
You mean the hunting challenges?
Yeah. Like there's these hunting ground challenges where if you succeed at them, you get some bonus loot and stuff like that.
It's just the loot we will talk about later.
And there were also the corrupted zones. So you have these particular zones where tougher versions of basic monsters come across. There were one or two of those that were just like, fuck me, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But the whole rest of the game was within my capacity. Mm. Admittedly, I did do that thing where I ground up the best gear about halfway through the game, and that made certain monsters pretty trivially easy to beat.
Yeah, that's something I encountered late game. I just basically had upgraded everything to a point where I felt like I could just grind my way through it.
But that's the thing. Some of the toughest monsters I didn't have that with. So the three big monsters, like the big, big monsters, right, are the Thunderjaw, which is sort of like a T-Rex thing. The Stormbird, which is like a giant rock.
Electric bird.
Yeah, yeah. And the Rockbreakers, I think they were called.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think technically the Behemoths are a monster of that size class as well, but those are a joke. They were so easy to beat. Those three, the Thunderjaw, every time I saw one, I would just attack it because I knew I could kill it in like 6 minutes and get some sick loot drops from it.
Yeah.
The Stormbird was, I think, the level where it was appropriately difficult for me. The Rock Breakers, though, they were always just so, so, so hard. I don't know. I just couldn't figure out what the tactic was.
Yeah, I just basically ground them down.
Yeah, a lot of the time I had to juke them where I would go to the edge of their proc radius and just kind of pot shots at them from a distance.
No,
like, I know that that's cheap, but like right at the end of the game, I think I might have figured them out. But especially Corrupted Rock Breakers had no fucking chance. They were so, so hard for me to fight. One thing I'll say as well that I think made the game a little bit tedious, if not necessarily difficult, is that elemental effects are really, really important.
Mm.
And though they tell you that elemental effects are very important,
and causing elemental damage is very important for fights,
they never actually explain how the HUD element for it works.
Yeah.
And every single person I spoke to about this had the same problem I did. I probably played this game for like 5 hours thinking I was setting people on fire or thinking I was freezing people and still having heaps of trouble in these fights because I hadn't actually done it.
And that's, you told me that in advance so that I knew going in.
Yeah, because I was tearing my hair out for some of these early fights.
Yeah, once you do fill that circle and it procs and they catch on fire, they freeze. It's so obvious that it's
like
happened.
They burst into fucking flames.
You could almost not have the HUD element if you knew that fact, because you could just figure out via that.
And one of the things that makes it confusing is that by default, damage numbers pop off the characters.
Oh, okay.
And so even if you haven't inflicted the status effect of they are on fire now or they are frozen now, the fire arrow still does damage over time. And so you're seeing the numbers pop off and you're like, yeah, he's on fire. I did it.
I turned those numbers off.
Yeah.
I always found them very annoying.
Still, as part of the back of my brain that I find very satisfying about just seeing that big number pop up when I hit someone really hard.
I can't fault the love of big numbers. So,
Yeah, but I mean, there's a couple of other little things like that. They have these tutorials that are buried in like three menus deep, and they never tell you that every time you get a new weapon, there's a tutorial mission that goes along with the weapon. They never tell you that. And so you stumble across it in like the fifth page of your quest log 5 hours after you got the weapon. It's like, why do you, there's like 1,000 experience just sitting here waiting for me. Why didn't you tell me that there was this mission here that would also train me how to use the weapon?
The problem was they just seemed so generic. I just couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
I just didn't do any of them. Like, no.
I did all of them. I just, like, if for no other reason than 1,000 experience early on in the game is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I at some point I realized that completing the story missions would give you skill points.
Yeah.
And so the game also is propelling you forward as well.
I like that, honestly. I think that's a good thing. I quite liked it.
So I kind of wasn't hunting for that XP because I knew I would get it as the game went
on. And that's the exact reason why I like it, that you don't feel compelled to grind alongside the story. Yeah. I like to do that, and I was still incentivized to do that with like gear drops.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't feel I needed to do that just to level up my character.
I was doing all of the side missions because I found them fun to do.
Mm.
And just talking to people and exploring the environment was engaging on its own. I think the only quests I was sort of doing in the game to see what the reward was is the Hunting Lodge mission. And that's only because they didn't tell me what it is. They were like, oh, you get a cool thing. And I'm like, what is it? And I'm like, we ain't gonna tell you. And I'm like, I must know.
Yeah. The Hunting Lodge.
I didn't complete it though. So.
Yeah. The Hunting Lodge is interesting because it's some of the least interesting story content, but for whatever reason, that's where they're like, this is where you get all the best gear.
Mm.
And I kind of get it because it's a game about hunting big mechasaurs or whatever. But by the time I was bored enough to be doing those quests, I had pretty much the best gear anyway. It was only very slight increases to what I was getting.
And
the challenge wasn't there. because I'd already killed 13 Thunderjaws, you know?
Yeah, that was my thing. I'm not saying that I'm the best gamer in the world, but I want to imply it right now. Because I would always just get the gold. Like, I'd always get the highest trophy. And they always go, wow, you got the highest trophy on your first time? That it was honestly getting boring.
Yeah.
It was getting annoying to just do it on the first go and have the guy go, wow, you're the best. And I'm like, hey, let's call your jets. I'm not playing on the hard difficulty. I'm just playing on normal. Like, you don't, I don't need that.
I had a similar experience. Like, about 80 to 90% of them, I was getting gold on the first try.
Another thing I noticed was, I feel that Aloy, who's the main character.
Aloy. Yeah. Aloy is her name, yeah. If it was Aloy, it would annoy me, but her name is Aloy. Her surrogate father's name is not Rust, it's Rost.
Yep. Okay. So Aloy.
The person who talks to you over the phone is not called Silence, he's called Silence.
So Aloy.
Aloy.
I forgot what point I was trying to make. Okay. How she moves through the world, I felt was really fluid. But there was a couple of moments here and there.
Yeah.
Where the game would kind of, it would be like, you might not be facing the right way, or you were not close enough, or you triggered an attack too early. So if you were like trying to strike from the shadows to, you know, take someone out without anyone noticing, if you just timed it wrong, you could have moved out of the way before you pushed the button.
Yeah.
And then you would just smack him. And then everyone will be like, hey, there's someone over there.
That's always really frustrating when you're going to do the silent assassination kill and you end up just doing a strike because you're in the tiniest wrong spot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of little things with the movement as well. Like, if you're just running along and there's a small little rock or a small little fence, you'll do sort of an Assassin's Creed style vault over it. She'll do like a little dynamic hop or skip or whatever. That was not a good enough system for me to rely on that.
Yeah.
I had to manually jump every time.
Yeah.
And it sucks because she looks very cool when she's doing it. Mm. And it comes to the
climbing.
Yeah. The climbing as well. It's like sometimes I'm getting her like up and down and up and down and up and down between like these two ledges because she won't just jump to the left.
I was thinking about how platforming works in games and how we've kind of moved away from that and all this stuff. There's something about the climbing that's nice to look at, but it's not super fun.
Yeah.
There's no puzzle, there's no challenge, it's you just glide through it. I love rock climbing and it's fun and engaging and a challenge and puzzling, and you've got to think and rely on your ability, and it's about managing all these things. And when you play a video game, climbing is like just flying with your arms.
Yeah,
right? The people basically run up walls, that's how fast they move, and there doesn't seem to be, there's no engagement to me.
Yeah, I agree, it's animated very well and looks very cool, but the actual process of doing it, you may as well be just walking down any other path in the game.
I realized
it's just a straight line.
I realized halfway through that I didn't need to press the jump button for most of the grabs.
Yeah.
Like, you just push the controller. You don't even need to be holding anything. You just grab onto a ledge and then all of a sudden she just glides up a wall.
On the point you were raised, this is sort of both points combined about the finicky positioning and the climbing. How many times did you try and use a grapple point and just fell to your fucking death?
Yes. So the game gives you these wonderful points where you can jump off a wall and throw a grappling hook and you slide on down. It looks really cool. Almost everyone. It was oddly consistent how often I would just walk off an edge.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I could jump and then trigger it halfway. Yeah. And then I would be like,
sometimes it was definitely on me.
Admittedly, for me, I felt that the checkpoint system they used was forgiving.
Because
every time I died foolishly, the game had like saved behind me without me realizing.
But this is the thing. Sometimes these grapple points are at the top of you get like achieving something. So you'll get to the top of this grapple point because there's a good piece of gear there or something like that. And sometimes the autosave would kick in as soon as you got the gear. Sometimes it wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know?
Like
you said, it's not a game breaker, but it's finicky. And it was just another thing. Every time I saw a grapple point, I had to go, okay, think before you hit the button.
And it just, that just breaks you out of that immersion. The game is so good at building because the world is so wonderful and you can remove all the HUD display. So it's just you and Aloy moving through the environment. I'm making sure to say it right. Moving through the environment, engaging with people, talking, chatting, sneaking and fighting monsters. And then all of a sudden you just jump off a cliff because the zone of triangle pressing is just very tight on that.
Yeah, it really is. One of the other things I was actually very surprised by was that this game includes a dialogue choice system.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was like, I was not expecting that at all. And admittedly, after sort of the first chunk of the game, it does only come up very rarely. Generally, you're watching cutscenes rather than doing a dialogue sequence.
Yeah.
You can ask questions to quest givers, but it isn't like choosing different options determines different outcomes.
This isn't Fallout, right?
Yeah, it isn't Mass Effect or whatever else.
There's no branching narrative.
But I thought that was interesting that existed at all. And the main reason I think it's there is because the way they sort of characterize Aloy is really interesting. Generally, when you have a choice, it falls into three options. Your compassionate option,
yep.
Your intelligent option,
yep.
Or your aggressive option.
Jerk option.
Yeah, and not necessarily jerk, but it might be like jerk. Physical strength and violence and intimidation and stuff like that.
Sure, sure.
And so the basic thing they're trying to do there is kind of show that Aloy is not just one kind of person, that she has different kinds of strengths, and that perhaps if you want to read it a little bit more broadly, that she doesn't have one kind of femininity that she expresses, that her compassion isn't a weakness, that her compassion doesn't detract from her intellect or from her physical capacity.
It's kind of like the three things she would say, they're always things she would say.
Yeah.
And even though you might choose one, it's not like she wouldn't have said the other things.
Yes. But under some circumstances, I did feel like the options were very heavily weighted to the intelligence one.
Yeah.
Just because, you kind of say, you've got the kind option, the quote, jerk option, and the actual smart and productive thing to say.
Mm.
And so a lot of the time, the smart thing was always like the way to outsmart the situation. And sometimes in the early part of the game, your compassionate response was not so much about being compassionate to the person you're speaking to or empathizing with them, but kind of being a little bit whiny about how it made you feel.
I don't know, David, being emotionally open and vulnerable is a really important thing we should
do. Yes, and that is true, but I do feel like in some of these early decisions, it was less about solving a problem and more about... I know that this sounds like it's me being judgmental. Sure. I'm trying to make it very clear that I felt the game was being judgmental about choosing the emotional response in this circumstance.
Hmm.
And that most of the time, intelligence was the canonical choice, for want of a better term.
I would disagree, but that's only because I ended up choosing the compassionate choice most of the time. And maybe this is just me colored by my own feelings.
And maybe it's me colored by my own feelings as well. Because I chose intelligence most of the time. I would choose compassion when it was relevant.
See, I would choose intelligence when it was relevant, but I was mostly choosing compassion. And the other one was just there.
Yeah. It's difficult because you don't want any one choice to be the exact right choice every time. But I also feel like if you're going to have a dialogue system, there does need to be some kind of consequence to choosing the other thing. So it's difficult to balance that in a way that doesn't front a particular strategy as the best one.
I think it was just there to help people engage a little bit more with this being you connecting with the character. Mm. And it's just one of those little tricks to get people into that mode of we're going on this journey. We agree on this thing. This is how we would both sort this out.
I think that there's an advantage to that as well. But we talk about this concept a lot, like how much agency should you give the player?
Yep.
And in a game that has a lot of interesting themes about science and about progress and all of that kind of stuff, which, again, we'll talk about after the spoilers.
We're almost there.
Having the player have control over which of these responses and which of, like, Aloy's traits they think is the most important, I think can actually undermine some of the themes that they're exploring when it comes to stuff about that.
Sure.
That'll become clearer when we talk about that later. But I think we're pretty much at the point now where we can lower the spoiler gate. Anybody who wants to play this spoiler-free, fuck off, basically.
Oh, I can see the look on your face when you said that, and you were just like, that was the wrong thing to say.
No, but honestly, thank you everybody for joining us, but we will move on into the spoiler territory.
Yep.
Continue if you wish, but you've been fucking warned. I don't want to hear one fucking word about it.
Oh, God, right? You're doubling down.
Yeah, I am. I'm tired. I'm tired of this shit.
He's tired.
I'm tired of every single week where someone listens to the spoiler thing after the spoiler thing. She's like, why'd you spoil it for me, jerk ass?
Yeah.
That happens all the time, a real thing.
Thanks, Greg.
All right. So, honestly, we've talked pretty high praise about this game so far, but we haven't even gotten to the good shit yet.
I know, right?
So, I think the thing that impressed me so much, I might have said this way back at the start of this episode, this game is very clever. The plot and the narrative written for this game is very smart. And I don't mean necessarily in the multi-layered, cinematography, all of the stuff under the hood. The actual content of the plot and the things that it makes you consider are just very well thought through. Like, it isn't just that there's stuff under the hood. It's that the content of the plot, the questions that it asks, and the points of consideration that the plot is putting in front of you are just much more advanced than I thought they would be. Like, it isn't, I was expecting, again, sort of on the Destiny level of, here's a sort of a sci-fi fantasy world. All of the characters have names that are basically words. All of the towns are named after the sun because these people like the sun and mechasaurs. I was expecting something very basic like that. But there's such a clever plot.
There'll be a bad guy and a good guy, and that will happen. Yeah, no, I expected that very rote plot, and I was just devouring the story, eager to just hear more about not only the world, but the people talk about it, the people struggle with the questions it was presenting.
Yeah.
Way the game was presenting that to you, like, was just set up to get me to care.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, I made the comparison to Avatar, the James Cameron film, earlier. I was expecting a plot kind of on that level, like you say, good guys, bad guys. Very, very simple ideological divide between them.
Nature is good. Oh, no, technology's the best.
Yeah, and they're going to fight about it. Technology's evil, everyone. But it's just, it's so fucking clever. And I think that part of the reason that it is clever, if I can put on my SJW hat for a moment, is because
Illuminati time.
Yeah, I think it's basically been written by people who are encouraged to think in a postmodern way, in an intersectional way about stuff like this. There isn't just a binary, this is good, this is bad. Everything is multifaceted. It also isn't just that really cheap thing of like, everyone's equally bad and we're just above it all. Like, it's not a cop-out. It's very considered and very clever. And we'll talk about all the individual ways in a moment. But the core plot is, I mean, a lot of you will probably know this, but the core plot is basically divided up into two
separate stories.
So not necessarily separate stories, but two sort of ways of exploring the stories. You've got Aloy in the present world figuring out what the big bad is up to and all of that kind of stuff. And then the mystery of what happened to human civilization before the collapse that is directly related to the events that are happening now.
You're right. They're not separate stories. Yeah. The stories link together. They're interwoven.
And it's paced very well. There is a real mystery there. And so even though you know pretty much immediately, okay, these cultists are interested in old technology, so you have a very real and understandable reason for exploring this stuff, how much stuff you don't know about the old world that's drip-fed to you over the course of it, and as you unravel and uncover that mystery, it's so, so interesting and so well-paced and just
I think the
perfectly delivered.
The beats between the stories, like, they're in sync. It's like dances. One story takes a step forward, then the other story matches up.
Yeah.
And they're always working with each other.
Yeah, and I think that we're past the spoiler point here, so just a basic, because we don't want to waste too much time on this.
Yeah, we also just want to repeat the story.
The basic history of the world is that shortly after our present day, sort of in the 2100s, Skynet apocalypse, right? These militarized robots go haywire and they are going to destroy the biosphere because they consume a biological material to generate fuel.
In emergency situations, they are designed to self-replicate.
Yeah.
However,
someone messed up.
Yep.
And one of the things I immediately like about this, it literally is a mistake. Yep. It isn't somebody
actually, you know what,
manipulating this technology for foul purposes. It is literally a bug
program. You know what this is? This is a grey goo scenario. It's not just technology's evil. Someone didn't think things through.
Someone fucked up, right? Yeah. My point of distinction is it's not Skynet. It's not that, oh, something became self-aware and now the machines are evil. It's not that this extremist individual hacked all the robots and whatever. It's literally some programmer or some assembly line person just didn't do their QA properly on this one. And so this range of robots has just flicked itself into emergency mode.
So when I was reading the text of the game, I felt like it was, they accidentally perfectly designed something that would do this.
Yeah.
And, like, the mistake is assembling a series of robots that do all of these things together.
Yeah. And I think that, like, because we're getting a little bit distracted here. The point is I'm supposed to be giving the basic plot.
Go for plot.
Like, so the basic plot is this happens, the world is in trouble.
Yeah.
And I really need to make this clear. Really, really big spoiler stuff here, guys. So what ancient society does is figure out that the biosphere is going to be destroyed by these robots and it's impossible to stop them.
Yep.
So they fall out a bunch of people. They put them in vaults until all of the robots power down after consuming the available biosphere.
No, they don't. There's no people in vaults. There's embryos in vaults.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry.
That's a very important distinction. Yeah. And it pulls into some of the themes of the game. I don't mean to distract.
Mm.
They specifically know that they can't just live underground.
Yeah.
We're not going to survive.
Yeah.
It is going to be a brand new race of people in our legacy.
Yeah.
Completely
and so basically,
unconnected from us.
What they do is they do the embryo thing. They store all of humanity's knowledge and they wait for the robots to consume the biosphere because they know it's impossible to stop them. And then the robots will go dormant because there's no fuel. What they also need is in the intervening time, they have their own AI that they programmed to hack the robots because it will literally take them something like 600 years to generate a shutdown code. Again, humanity is not going to live to that date.
Yeah. When they start this project, I think they have like 100 days. Like it's something.
Yeah, it's something like before the entire biosphere collapses.
Yeah.
That's what they do in the past. Then the AI at this point is supposed to take all of the embryos, all of the stored seeds, all of the stored genetic information and terraform a now barren planet.
Yep.
And then eventually, when it's livable, put people back in there. The reason that all of the technological knowledge that they stored alongside doesn't come out isn't super important, but the point is eventually when it comes to the time where humanity is supposed to reclaim the Earth, they do so without any of the knowledge that was stored by the old ones,
it
as
doesn't,
they call it.
Yeah, it doesn't go perfectly. And, like, I want to say, so I don't go on about it, the beats and the detail and the way it's presented is so engaging.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I needed to quickly go through those two forms of the plot, is that the mystery of unraveling that is fascinating. And as they examine this kind of thing, you have different characters that you see holo recordings of from the old times and characters in the current world, and they use them to explore themes in really, really interesting ways. So Aloy, as you mentioned, very early on gets this focus, which is a relic of the old world. It's a piece of technology. It's basically a
what our phones will be very soon.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of these things. It sits on her temple, gives her a heads-up display, and it teaches her all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So she gets that when she's a child and has a much more accurate understanding of how the world functions and a much stronger interest in science and
exploration,
and logic discovery. And exploration and curiosity and discovery and all that kind of stuff than most of the other people in her part of the world, which are much more focused on tradition and, you know, community living and that kind of stuff. And you hear something like that. Protagonist likes logic and critical thinking and science. Her culture has made her an outcast for traditional reasons, reasons related to tradition.
Oh.
A very clear dichotomy, right? Well, no, it's very complex, and they never just outright dismiss faith and tradition and community in response to Aloy's cold logic, because they also have characters that represent a much more extreme version of that. Knowledge is power. Progress for progress's sake. And those characters are dangerous as well. And it's just so nuanced in the way they explore themes like that.
There's a moment where someone who's helping you reveals how much they've actually caused the situation you're in.
Yeah.
And you ask them about it. You talk to them about it. And I said to him, well, it's fine because you're trying to work it out and you're working to stop it. And then he just goes, yeah, but I'd do it again. Like, I would just do it again with more safeguards, perhaps, but I would do it again.
Yeah.
This idea of this desire, unpeded possession.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's obviously there's parallels with like Oppenheimer and Von Braun and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, the Manhattan Project scientists.
Yeah, yeah.
Connections the game sometimes brings up in
very
terms
deliberately.
Of the project.
It's a very easy comparison to make. But the robots that go crazy and destroy the biosphere. You were talking about how they try to design these robots to be like the perfect example of what they are. And it's more than any other game or even probably movie that I've seen, a very explicit criticism of tech culture right now.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about, like you said, the Manhattan Project as a really obvious example of this, but we don't really ask questions about things like machine learning as much as we should and what it means for things like, you know, net neutrality is a big debate in America right now. A lot of these little things about, well, we can perfect this with our science. we're not supposed to sit down here and, you know, think about all of the ways it could be used evilly. We're trying to make the best thing that we can. That's our job, is to pursue this. Yeah. And these robots that they created, there are so many little things, just like, how do you not have a master shutdown code? Because we wanted to make a hackable robot.
Yeah, because if you make a hackable robot, then it won't be the perfect robot.
It's not a perfect military robot if the enemy can hack it. So we made the robots unhackable.
Yeah, of course. Why?
And the guy's like, why didn't... But what? How? And it's like, because that's what you wanted when we built them.
Listen,
like,
we wanted a deterrent that no one could stop, so we built a bomb that would go off.
Yeah. And again, like, to say, oh, cautionary tales about sci-fi presented in audio logs that you find in abandoned facilities, it sounds so trite. But like I said, it's just very, very nuanced. It's presented very well. And you get such a strong... Every person is a character as well. And that contributes so much to how interesting this all is.
I think something interesting, too, to talk about is, you know, the game has text logs.
Mm.
It does have recordings. And I think the key thing that you mentioned just then is their characters.
Yeah.
Like, I know who the character of Tate is, this weird coder who's gross.
But yeah, like a hardcore anarchist.
Yeah. Right? And I know of the vegan scientist who was working on the, I think it was a refab project. And these are real people presented to you.
Yeah. And Aloy, and again, this is spoiler stuff here. Aloy is outcast from her tribe because she was born without a mother. They just found her in a mountain cave. And it turns out that the reason Aloy was born is that she was a clone of the character who originally set up the project that would refertilize the planet.
Yeah.
And shit goes wrong, and the AI that's in charge of terraforming the planet is like, well, shit, the only person I know who can save this is the person who built me. Let's make another one of her. And so it's a little bit, but it's really interesting as well, because there's so many themes in this game. We've already talked about, you know, the power of science and science versus tradition, but there's also this idea of legacy and inheritance and sort of the responsibility of generations after and what burden they're supposed to carry. So Aloy is this clone of Elizabeth, and Elizabeth is responsible for this original Zero Dawn project, which is sort of a problem that she inherited from her former boss who created the robot.
Yeah.
But the former boss would not have been able to create those robots without her expertise in the first place.
Yeah, so there's like this chain of cause and effect.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of allusion made to the idea of, even though Aloy is a clone of Elizabeth, she sort of feels like Elizabeth is her mother to some extent. And she has inherited the
responsibilities
of this person who, you know, is in some ways culpable for the state of the planet.
Yeah.
You also have all of this stuff with the Kaja, right? Who are, there's sort of this other tribe, and like a few generations ago, they were enslaving people and they were
murdering them. Yeah. And blood sacrifices.
Yeah. There were genocidal attacks against the Nora. And we're at a point now where the king who was responsible for a lot of that has been usurped, and his, I think, younger brother is on the throne now.
His son.
Oh, it's his son. Okay, yep. I thought it was his younger brother. Anyway, someone else is on the throne now. And so he's inherited the responsibility of this situation and how he's got to correct it. But there's a lot of talk about the society as a whole, that the society as a whole has benefited from slavery, and they have benefited from...
That's how they built their magnificent city I was talking about being really beautiful before.
And so there are a lot of themes about... Not necessarily colonialism explicitly, but the cultural boons of previous atrocities and what the responsibility of the current citizen is to that. Unfortunately, there are a couple of quests where they pretty explicitly say, hey, we should leave these monuments built by slaves up as a reminder, which politically doesn't mesh with me.
And they always present it like the people who were slaves were the ones saying that too.
Yeah. There's this idea that like, hey, you know, my father was, was worked to death building this elevator.
Or my lover.
Yeah. And I want this elevator to stay there. Otherwise they died for nothing. And I don't want to say that that's a wrong way to think, but considering how, as I said, how complex a lot of the themes are explored in this, this particular one is a little bit more black and white than the others. And that's a bit disappointing for something that is a very important discussion that's happening right now, you know?
there was something I noticed as I was going through the game and reading up on these stories and looking into the past, and it's the idea that, like, everyone in the past knows how bad we were treating the environment.
Yeah, it's like it's not even a question.
Yeah, there's, like, some sort of cultural touchstone that's happened where everyone just accepts they were fucking up the planet.
Yeah.
And there was just something there about presenting this world where everyone accepts humanity's culpability in engaging with the environment.
Well, I think it's important to make this note. The people you hear from are all generally scientists and stuff. And this is also occurring in, as you said, like 2060 or something like that. Today, most people of that community accept that we are fucking up the planet.
Yeah.
The question is more about whether or not we should care that we're doing that. And there are definitely characters who, even if they have that knowledge, still don't really care that much. Ted Farrow is an example. He's the one who built the evil robots, basically. His company built the evil robots.
God, that's so evil.
And so there definitely is a very strong environmentalist message in the game as a whole. And I think that when you talk about, oh, hearing that all of these people accept that climate change is real and the way we're treating the planet is unacceptable. The reason they talk about the way we're treating the planet being unacceptable is because there are still characters in the world treating the planet terribly. So it's not a solved problem in the game world. But you are correct. There's definitely an environmental message. But once again, it's not a simple one of all technology is bad, destroy all progress. You know what was great? How all humanity had to drag itself out of the dirt all over again.
Because
losing all of the knowledge was a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much not that black and white.
Yeah.
So definitely a pro-environmental message, but not at the expense of our curiosity or our progress.
Yeah, you basically just get to witness a whole bunch of people have to make really tough decisions and to frame them in a way that doesn't undermine the agency of the characters.
Yeah.
Especially when you get to that core past story.
Mm.
You know, like the most full-on moment for me is when people finally find out what Project Zero Dawn is about.
Just to help clarify, most of the world thinks that Zero Dawn is a project to defeat the robots. Only the people who are working on it know that there is absolutely no hope and we are just trying to store what we can to rebuild the planet half a millennium down the track.
That moment when you find out what enduring victory is.
Yeah.
But anyway, when people learn, they have three options presented to them. Join the project, permanent detention, euthanasia.
Yeah.
And then they present you with people that go through all of those different experiences.
Mm.
And not only do they have discussions and dialogues around the counselors who are engaging these scientists and cultural people and how they should show respect and everything. Each person has a nuanced reason for why they take certain options.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just very impressive to see.
Yeah, it really was. A lot of incredibly good writing and character work and voice acting was done in all of those parts.
It's not odd that I get emotional about a voice entry on a tablet I found in a game somewhere.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of the time. I found myself very confronted.
Yeah, it's really confronting sometimes, very compelling sometimes. It's very emotional. Like, it's excellently well done.
Yeah.
And there are some twists and turns in there that we won't ruin because they're amazingly good. One of the other things that I think is important to talk about as well is you get insight into the scope of the Zero Dawn project that is so fucking fascinating. So you have this AI that they're building who's going to refertilize the planet, but the contingencies they build in, because they're planning for a millennium of time that they won't be around to govern.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this idea of Hades, and Hades is effectively the...
One of the villains.
One of the villains, yeah. Yep. But Hades is another AI, and the purpose of Hades is if the Gaia AI who's refertilizing the planet gets to a point where the biosphere isn't being constructed properly or basically it's a write-off. You know, we've fucked up. It's unsalvageable. Hades comes in and burns it back to zero. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of this AI. And so the people who are working on Zero Dawn are building in a fail-safe, which is the apocalypse again.
Yep.
And I think it was Tate in his recording, he talks about, like, you know, we don't know how many times it's going to take her to get it right, and we need to make sure that Hades can come in at the right time, reset the planet, and then give control back to Gaia. And this idea that it's like, how many apocalypses will it take
to
bring the world back to where it's supposed to be? And just the scope, the incredible scope of that, and how, again, that plays into all of these themes about what the responsibility of science and progress is, what kind of consideration is required when we do these things. I mean, the final cutscene of the game, is Elizabeth recounting a story of her as a child,
yeah,
where she was trying to develop a better battery and set a tree on fire. And the tree burned. The tree, she says something like the tree had been standing there for 100 or 150 years.
Yeah.
And in 35 seconds of curiosity, I burnt it down and I killed every bird that nested in that tree.
Yeah.
And it's a very clear allegory for what the narrative as a whole is. And I feel like I'm just saying this over and over again, but the brilliance of this game is how well it balances all of these different arguments and all of these different, you know, themes that it's going through. It doesn't just hammer home one blunt, massively oversimplified position. It's really asking for critical thought,
yeah,
from its audience and critical thought in all of these things. Like, there's no universal right or wrong. Silence as a character who's all about knowledge and progress and curiosity and science.
Who is played by Lance Reddick? From Fringe, which I have to mention now.
Yes, because we promised we would mention that like an hour ago.
And he's amazing and I love him. But
yeah,
good voice talent.
Yeah, amazingly well voice acted. So you've got this character who's, when we say morally bankrupt, like, I don't mean he's a jerk. I mean that morality is something he deliberately avoids considering because he feels like it filters his pursuit of knowledge, right? And on the other side, you've got Hellas, who's the leader of the cultist, and he's all about this divine right of his people and his superiority. Yeah. And so these are two of the strongest forces in the game, and both of them are on opposite ends of this spectrum, whereas most other, particularly video games, but even a lot of other what we consider, you know, more complex narrative art, really does still do, oh, if the bad guy is wrong, then the opposite of what he wants is right. And if the good person likes this, then the opposite of what the good person likes is wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas Aloy is just, again, she practices a much deeper level of moral weight and moral consideration than other characters in the game. And so it's very, very advanced and it's fucking awesome. Just while we still have a few minutes at the end here, we should actually talk about representation in this game.
Yeah.
It is pretty good. You have many people of color.
Yeah, it's like, you know how people always go, oh, in a fantasy setting, you know, you can't have people of color, which is a lie. They were like, oh, it's the future. We can just make it so diverse everywhere.
So it does have a very diverse cast and that's great.
Like the main cast, but all the background characters everywhere, no matter which tribe, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They're all still diverse.
Mm.
And also there are characters who are same sex attracted and like that isn't brought up as like conflict in the world.
Mm.
It's just a part of nature. Like,
yeah absolutely. And one of the things, like, this sounds perhaps a little bit dicey to say, a lot of the time when games include diverse characters, without it even necessarily being tokenism, you might see some obvious kinds of diversity, but other kinds of diversity are overlooked. So it's more common to see people of color of African descent in film than it is to see people of color of Asian or South Asian or Hispanic descent in certain kinds of films. Whereas this game really does a much more broad range of races in its cast. And so that's all like really just refreshing to see because it's effortless, right? It's just in the NPCs. It's just not a big deal.
It's just nice.
And I think that part of what makes that so obvious is there is a character who is, I'm trying to figure out the best way to put this. They're not cisgendered, right? It's never made explicit whether they're a trans man or if they're gender fluid or anything like that.
Yep.
But Aloy makes reference to them being a woman. They reject that notion and talk about how they belong in this warrior caste that's traditionally only for men because they prove their strength over time. So it's nice to see the inclusion, but I am not the first person to say it is clumsy because it does rely on some gender stereotypes to establish that this person is not cisgendered and things like that. We might link some stuff. I mean, Laura Dale wrote something about it.
That sounds like someone to link it.
Yeah. It is kind of clumsy. There is also a little bit of exotification because you have the Nora who are clearly inspired by Native American cultures. Mm. And then you've got other groups that are inspired by other tribal or historical communities that I am not as immediately able to recognize. I think the Oseram are sort of around sort of like medieval Turkish kind of a look, and then you've got the Kaja, and that's very dicey for me to try and pin down exactly what they're inspired by, but there's a lot of different things. There's sort of some Roman stuff in there and some more Mayan stuff in there as well. It's a big grab bag. So I think there is a certain level of exotification there, but again, I'm not really in a position to comment on that with much expertise. Mm-hmm. I just didn't want to leave it unmentioned, you know?
Yeah, there's something there. I'm not 100% sure on it though. Yeah.
Yeah. One other thing that I think is very interesting is that Aloy, as we mentioned, she's an outcast from the Nora because she's born motherless, right? Yeah. And I think she says this pretty explicitly in a conversation with the king of the Kaja people.
Bad.
That when she's among the Nora, they call her outcast. And when she's among other communities, they call her Nora. And it's just a very good, strong nod towards this idea of intersectionality that, like, the way people judge you by your identity changes based on what their own experience of identity is, and that Aloy isn't just a woman or just a Nora, that like her experience of different identity categories affect how she's treated in varying ways in different parts of the world. And again, it's just a very nice postmodern contemporary informed way to discuss identity in a game like this.
Yeah.
And it's something you see so rarely that, that they even acknowledge that that kind of judgment and that variation of judgment exists, you know?
Yeah, I can't think of any other game that does that.
Yeah, yeah. This is a very small point as well, but I really do like this too. One of the things that I appreciate about the game is that a lot of the time when you have a female protagonist in a game, and she's supposed to be a strong female protagonist, she becomes strong because they eliminate elements of her femininity. So she's not emotional, because that's what weak women would do. She's a strong woman. She's strong like Master Chief or strong like Marcus Fenix. So she doesn't have emotions.
They basically turn her into a stereotype of a male character.
Aloy is able to be strong without her femininity being assassinated by the writers. And one really refreshing example of this is that, I mean, we don't really get a completely explicit confirmation of this, but Aloy is at least interested in men. And male characters in the world will flirt with her in a way that isn't weird and creepy and totally disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a respectable way that they kind of express attraction towards her. And it isn't like we as the players aren't meant to be grossed out by that, or, you know, it's just a very natural way for her to exist in the world as someone who is an impressive woman.
They don't frame it with the straightforward, awkward dialogue.
Yeah.
They'll have other characters remark on people watching or things like that. There's like one moment where two characters who flirt with Aloy, it's like one of the guys, oh, he's looking at me a lot. I wonder why he's doing that. And he's just like little real details like that. And, and the way they talk to each other.
She's only like 17 or something as well.
I don't know.
She's somewhere between like 17 and 20. But like, so some elements of naivety from her in that are kind of believable considering the culture that she's grown up in and the fact that she...
And then there's also some elements where it's like, hey, we need to save the world right now.
Yeah. So you get, there are three male characters that express attraction towards Aloy. One is, I forget his name, but the son of the war chief from the Nora tribe.
Oh, that's Vala?
Yeah, Val or something like that. I cannot remember his name.
It starts with V.
There's also the other character whose name I can't remember.
Oh, boy.
Who's the Oseram guy.
Yep. Erad?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I should know this.
Ariad or something.
I played the game today.
And then you also have the King of the Kaja.
I'm pretty sure he's it.
Now, the first two, when they express attraction towards Aloy, it's very respectful and healthy, and you almost wouldn't even consider it flirting if you... Okay, I'll say this again. People who aren't as aware as they should be might not recognize that it's flirting. But the characters are deliberately flirting, and Aloy kind of recognizes that they're flirting.
There's a moment where I was like, is he flirting with me? Is this what this is going on?
No, like, I was very much like, all right. Yeah, I see what's going on here.
Yeah.
And so the first two do it in, like I said, a very respectful way. It's about expressing their admiration, is probably the most accurate term for it, for Aloy and what she can do.
Yeah.
Third character expresses an attraction towards Aloy because they have just lost their partner and they are transferring.
Yes.
And Aloy has the three options that come up, and every single one of them is calling him on it.
Yes.
And it's very, very good.
Yeah.
You can either be polite and say, I think you need to look at yourself and ask yourself what's happening here in sort of like a more psychological, analytical way.
Yeah.
Or you can be like, dude, think about it.
Yeah.
And what I really like about that is, again, I spent a lot of words to get to this point. There's that bullshit thing people say about how, oh, most games are played by straight white men, and so we shouldn't have lady protagonists. And if we have lady protagonists, no one can ever hit on them, because we want our straight white men to think that they can have sex with their protagonist. And that's... and if a male character flirts with them while they're the protagonist, that's gay.
That totally fake situation you mentioned is gross.
Mm. It's really depressing how prevalent that view is among straight white male gamers, but it's really fucking refreshing to see such a big budget game say, fuck off with that. Like, it's just really nice to be like, yeah, she's a woman, she likes dudes, and sometimes they're going to hit on her because she's rad as fuck.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Deal with
it. You fucking insecure prick. It's just really nice. It's like an example, like you say, of, you know, there are same-sex attracted people in the world. Nobody acts like it's a big deal. People of multiple races, nobody acts like it's a big deal.
It's not like in The
Sometimes,
Witcher.
Sometimes men express their attraction to women in a really respectful and no, totally not creepy way. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, what is it in The Witcher where there's an episode where it's revealed one of the characters is gay on this quest very early on, and it's like, it's almost like a, hey, we're doing this thing now. And
yeah.
I'm like,
it's a really conscious acknowledgement. And The Witcher is going for a very different kind of world. It isn't looking for a place that's, you know, nice to be in.
That's definitely true.
The world of Horizon Zero Dawn uses how pleasant its world is, not just to be, you know, nice for less hegemonic folk like myself, to be nice, to be welcoming to people who are women, who might be queer in some way, who might be gender diverse or not white.
Yes.
But it also uses the pleasantness of that world to interact with the themes I was talking about before, about how, you know, maybe knowledge isn't the best thing ever all the time, but sometimes it pretty much is. And it's
complex.
It's very, very good and very nice and very good.
Yep. It's so nice to have a lovely time on like all fronts, you know, to be engaged with the game, engaged with playing it, invested in the story. Had a grand old time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would just like, if anyone can get a chance to experience it, or like David, borrow my PS4 and play it, you should totally do that.
Well, that's Horizon Zero Dawn all finished up. If you like what we do, you can find us on iTunes. Our website is slowpokespodcast.com. Our Twitter is @slowpokescast. Our Facebook is facebook.com/slowpokespodcast. We're also on YouTube.
Yes.
There as well. Yep. You can see some stuff.
If you go to our website, you'll see the YouTube links, or if you go to any of our places, they're all there.
So hopefully this was a strong opening to our third season.
Mm-hmm.
John, why don't you tell our listeners what season 3 holds for them in a fortnight from now?
So next fortnight, we're going to be talking about Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
Now, I am extremely excited for this
for
two reasons. One, like 5 or 6 years ago, Extra Credits did a game you might not have tried, and this was one of them. It was like, I think maybe even their first one.
5 or 6 years ago.
And I bought it like a week after I saw that and have not played it yet. The second reason is that this is made by the developers of A Way Out, which was previewed at E3 of 2017.
Yep.
And that looks really, really, really good.
Yeah, and I'm very curious to see what Brothers is like and explore that, because I'm interested so much in A Way Out, and I want to know what they're...
Yeah, and see, so for me, both games, both Brothers and A Way Out, they have a central gimmick.
Yeah.
And I want to play Brothers to see if it's really just that and nothing else, or if there's...
something there.
Yeah, how interestingly they explore that.
Yeah.
Because if Brothers is good, I will let myself become excited for A Way Out. But at this point in time right now, I am still restraining myself, because I don't want to set myself up for disappointment.
Well, tune in next fortnight and you will hear how we feel, if David is disappointed or not. And
we'll take bets. What do you think the spread on that is?
I mean, there's some pretty good odds, actually. Yeah. I would take that bet. But anyway, I've been John.
I've been David.
And this has been Horizon Zero Dawn.
Thanks for joining us.